The Bandwin in those days, and moreover, the shadow of Dol Guldur was lengthening. When, therefore, they heard of the overthrow of the Witch-King, they sought more room in the north, and drove away the remnants of the people of Angmar on the east side of the mountains. But in the days of Leod, father of Eol, they had grown to be a numerous people, and were again somewhat straitened in the land of their home. In the 2510th year of the Third Age, a new peril threatened Gondor. A great host of wild men from the northeast swept over Rovanion, and coming down out of the Brownlands, crossed the Anduin on rafts. At the same time, by chance or design, the Orcs, who at that time, before their war with the dwarves, were in great strength, made a descent from the mountains. The invaders overran Cullenarthen, and Cirion, steward of Gondor, sent north for help, for there had been long friendship between the men of Anduin's Vale and the people of Gondor. But in the valley of the river men were now few and scattered, and slow to render such aid as they could. At last tidings came to Eol of the need of Gondor, and late though it seemed, he set out with a great host of riders. Thus he came to the Battle of the Field of Celebrant, for that was the name of the Greenland that lay between Silverlode and Limlight. There the northern army of Gondor was in peril. Defeated in the wold, and cut off from the south, it had been driven across the Limlight, and was then suddenly assailed by the Orc host that pressed it towards the Anduin. All hope was lost when, unlooked for, the riders came out of the north and broke upon the rear of the enemy. Then the fortunes of battle were reversed, and the enemy was driven with slaughter over Limlight. Eol led his men in pursuit, and so great was the fear that went before the horsemen of the north, that the invaders of the world were also thrown into panic, and the riders hunted them over the plains of Cullenarthen. The people of that region had become few since the plague, and most of those that remained had been slaughtered by the savage Easterlings. Cirion, therefore, in reward for his aid, gave Cullenarthen, between Anduin and Isen, to Eol and his people, and they sent north for their wives and children and their goods and settled in that land. They named it anew the Mark of the Riders, and they called themselves the Eolingers, but in Gondor their land was called Rohan, and its people the Rohirrim, that is, the Horse Lords. Thus Eol became the first king of the Mark, and he chose for his dwelling a green hill before the feet of the white mountains that were the south wall of his land. There the Rohirrim lived afterwards as free men, under their own kings and laws, but in perpetual alliance with Gondor. Many lords and warriors, and many fair and valiant women, are named in the songs of Rohan that still remember the north. Frumgar, they say, was the name of the chieftain who led his people to Eotheod. Of his son, Fram, they tell that he slew Skarther, the great dragon of Ered Mithrin, and the land had peace from the Longworms afterwards. Thus Fram won great wealth, but was at feud with the dwarves, who claimed the hoard of Skarther. Fram would not yield them a penny, and sent to them instead the teeth of Skarther, made into a necklace, saying, "Jewels such as these you will not match in your treasures, for they are hard to come by." Some say that the dwarves slew Fram for this insult. There was no great love between Eotheod and the dwarves. Leod was the name of Eol's father. He was a tamer of wild horses, for there were many at that time in the land. He captured a white foal, and it grew quickly to a horse, strong and fair and proud. No man could tame it. When Leod dared to mount it, it bore him away, and at last threw him, and Leod's head struck a rock, and so he died. He was then only 42 years old, and his son was a youth of 16. Eol vowed that he would avenge his father. He hunted long for the horse, and at last he caught sight of him, and his companions expected that he would try to come within bowshot and kill him. But when they drew near, Eol stood up and called him in a loud voice, "Come hither, man's bane, and get a new name." To their wonder the horse looked towards Eol, and came and stood before him, and Eol said, Feilaroff I name you. You loved your freedom, and I do not blame you for that, but now you owe me a great weregild, and you shall surrender your freedom to me until your life's end. Then Eol mounted him, and Feilaroff submitted, and Eol rode him home without bit or bridle, and he rode him in like fashion ever after. The horse understood all that men said, though he would allow no man but Eol to mount him. It was upon Feilaroff that Eol rode to the field of Celebrant, for that horse proved as long-lived as men, and so were his descendants. They were the Mearas, who would bear no one but the king of the Mark or his sons until the time of Shadowfax. Men said of them that Bamer, whom the elder called Orome, must have brought their sire from west over sea. Of the kings of the Mark between Eol and Theoden, most is said of Helm Hammerhand. He was a grim man of great strength. There was at that time a man named Freka, who claimed descent from King Freowine, though he had, men said, much Dunlendish blood, and was dark-haired. He grew rich and powerful, having wide lands on either side of the Ardorn. Near its source he made himself a stronghold, and paid little heed to the king. Helm mistrusted him, but called him to his councils, and he came when it pleased him. To one of these councils Freka rode with many men, and he asked the hand of Helm's daughter for his son, Wulf. But Helm said, "You have grown big since you were last here, but it is mostly fat, I guess." And men laughed at that, for Freka was wide in the belt. Then Freka fell in a rage, and reviled the king, and said this at the last, "Old kings that refuse a proffered staff may fall on their knees." Helm answered, "Come, the marriage of your son is a trifle. Let Helm and Freka deal with it later. Meanwhile the king and his council have matters of moment to consider." When the council was over, Helm stood up and laid his great hands on Freka's shoulder, saying, "The king does not permit brawls in his house, but men are freer outside." And he forced Freka to walk before him out from Edoras into the field. To Freka's men that came up he said, "Be off. We need no hearers. We are going to speak of a private matter alone. Go and talk to my men." And they looked and saw that the king's men and his friends far outnumbered them, and they drew back. "Now, Dunlending," said the king, "you have only Helm to deal with, alone and unarmed. But you have said much already, and it is my turn to speak. Freka, your folly has grown with your belly. You talk of a staff. If Helm dislikes a crooked staff that is thrust on him, he breaks it. So." With that he smote Freka such a blow with his fist that he fell back stunned, and died soon after. Helm then proclaimed Freka's son and near kin the king's enemies, and they fled, for at once Helm sent many men riding to the west marches. 4 years later, in 2758, great troubles came to Rohan, and no help could be sent from Gondor, for 3 fleets of the corsairs attacked it, and there was war on all its coasts. At the same time, Rohan was again invaded from the east, and the Dunlending, seeing their chance, came over the Isen and down from Isengard. It was soon known that Wulf was their leader. They were in great force, for they were joined by enemies of Gondor that landed in the mouths of Lefnui and Isen. The Rohirrim were defeated, and their land was overrun, and those who were not slain or enslaved fled to the dales of the mountains. Helm was driven back with great loss from the crossings of Isen, and took refuge in the Hornburg and the ravine behind, which was after known as Helm's Deep. There he was besieged. Wulf took Edoras, and sat in Medoseld, and called himself king. There Haleth, Helm's son, fell, last of all, defending the doors. Soon afterwards the long winter began, and Rohan lay under snow for nearly 5 months. Both the Rohirrim and their foes suffered grievously in the cold, and in the dearth that lasted longer. In Helm's Deep there was a great hunger after Yule, and being in despair, against the king's counsel, Harmar, his younger son, led men out on a sortie and foray. But they were lost in the snow. Helm grew fierce and gaunt for famine and grief, and the dread of him alone was worth many men in the defence of the Borg. He would go out by himself, clad in white, and stalk like a snow-troll into the camps of his enemies, and slay many men with his hands. It was believed that if he bore no weapon, no weapon would bite on him. The Dunlendings said that if he could find no food, he ate men. That tale lasted long in Dunland. Helm had a great horn, and soon it was marked that before he sallied forth, he would blow a blast upon it that echoed in the deep. And then, so great a fear fell on his enemies, that instead of gathering to take him or kill him, they fled away down the coombe. One night men heard the horn blowing, but Helm did not return. In the morning there came a sun-gleam, the first for long days, and they saw a white figure standing still on the dyke, alone, for none of the Dunlendings dared come near. There stood Helm, dead as a stone, but his knees were unbent. Yet men said that the horn was still heard at times in the deep, and the wraith of Helm would walk among the foes of Rohan and kill men with fear. Soon after the winter broke. Then Freyalaf, son of Hild, Helm's sister, came down out of Dunharrow, to which many had fled. And with a small company of desperate men he surprised Wulf in Meadowseld and slew him, and regained Edoras. There were great floods after the snows, and the Vale of Entwash became a vast fen. The eastern invaders perished or withdrew, and there came help at last from Gondor, by the roads both east and west of the mountains. Before the year 2759 was ended, the Dunlendings were driven out, even from Isengard, and then Freyalaf became king. Helm was brought from the Hornborg and laid in the ninth mound. Ever after, the white symbol Muna grew there most thickly, so that the mound seemed to be snow-clad. When Freyalaf died, a new line of mounds was begun. The Rohirrim were grievously reduced by war and dearth and loss of cattle and horses, and it was well that no great danger threatened them again for many years, for it was not until the time of King Folkwine that they recovered their former strength. It was at the crowning of Freyalaf that Saruman appeared, bringing gifts, and speaking great praise of the valour of the Rohirrim. All thought him a welcome guest. Soon after, he took up his abode in Isengard. For this, Beren, steward of Gondor, gave him leave, for Gondor still claimed Isengard as a fortress of its realm, and not part of Rohan. Beren also gave into Saruman's keeping the keys of Orthonk. That tower no enemy had been able to harm or to enter. In this way, Saruman began to behave as a lord of men. For at first he held Isengard as a lieutenant of the steward and warden of the tower. But Freyalaf was as glad as Beren to have this so, and to know that Isengard was in the hands of a strong friend. A friend he long seemed, and maybe, in the beginning, he was one in truth. Though afterwards there was little doubt in men's minds that Saruman went to Isengard in hope to find the stone still there, and with the purpose of building up a power of his own. Certainly after the last White Council, in 2953, his designs towards Rohan, though he hid them, were evil. He then took Isengard for his own, and began to make it a place of guarded strength and fear, as though to rival the Barad Dur. His friends and servants he drew then from all who hated Gondor and Rohan, whether men or other creatures more evil. The Kings of the Mark. First line. The first king was Eorl the Young. He was born in 2485. He was so named because he succeeded his father in youth, and remained yellow-haired and ruddy to the end of his days. These were shortened by a renewed attack of the Easterlings. Eol fell in battle in the Wold, and the first mound was raised. Felaroth was laid there also. The second king was Brego, born 2512. He drove the enemy out of the Wold, and Rohan was not attacked again for many years. In 2569 he completed the Great Hall of Medoseld. At the feast, his son Baldur vowed that he would tread the paths of the dead, and did not return. Brego died of grief the next year. The third king, Aldor the Old, was born in 2544. He was Brego's second son. He became known as the Old, since he lived to a great age, and was king for 75 years. In his time, the Rohirrim increased, and drove out or subdued the last of the Dunlendish people that lingered east of Isen. Harrowdale and the other mountain valleys were settled. Of the next three kings little is said, for Rohan had peace and prospered in their time. The fourth king, Freya, was born in 2570. Eldest son, but fourth child of Aldor, he was already old when he became king. The fifth king was Freyawine, born 2594. The sixth, Goldwine, 2619. The seventh king, Deor, was born in 2644. In his time the Dunlendings raided often over the Isen. In 2710 they occupied the deserted ring of Isengard, and could not be dislodged. The eighth king, Gram, was born in 2668. The ninth king, Helm Hammerhand, was born in 2691. At the end of his reign, Rohan suffered great loss by invasion and the long winter. Helm and his sons, Harleth and Harma, perished. Freyalaf, Helm's sister son, became king. The second line. This line began with the tenth king, Freyalaf Hildeson, born 2726. In his time, Saruman came to Isengard, from which the Dunlendings had been driven. The Rohirrim at first profited by his friendship in the days of dearth and weakness that followed. The 11th king, Britta, born 2752, was called by his people Leofa, for he was loved by all. He was open-handed and a help to all the needy. In his time there was war with the orcs that, driven from the north, sought refuges in the White Mountains. When he died it was thought that they had all been hunted out, but it was not so. The 12th king, Walda, born 2780, was king only 9 years. He was slain with all his companions when they were trapped by orcs as they rode by mountain paths from Dunharrow. The 13th king, Falker, 2804, was a great hunter, but he vowed to chase no wild beast while there was an orc left in Rohan. When the last orc hold was found and destroyed, he went to hunt the great boar of Everholt in the Firion Wood. He died of the tusk wounds that it gave him. The 14th king was Falkwine, born 2830. When he became king, the Rohirrim had recovered their strength. He reconquered the West March, between Ardorn and Isen, that Dunlendings had occupied. Rohan had received great help from Gondor in the evil days. When, therefore, he heard that the Haradrim were assailing Gondor with great strength, he sent many men to the help of the steward. He wished to lead them himself, but was dissuaded, and his twin sons, Falkred and Fastred, born 2858, went in his stead. They fell side by side in battle in Ithilien. Turin the Second of Gondor sent to Falkwine a rich weirgild of gold. The 15th king, Fengal, was born in 2870. He was the third son and fourth child of Falkwine. He's not remembered with praise. He was greedy of food and of gold, and at strife with his marshals and with his children. Thengel, his third child and only son, left Rohan when he came to manhood, and lived long in Gondor, and won honour in the service of Turgon. The 16th king, Thengel, was born in 2905. He took no wife until late, but in 2943 he wedded Morwen of Lossarnoch in Gondor, though she was 17 years the younger. She bore him 3 children in Gondor, of whom Théoden, the second, was his only son. When Fengal died, the Rohirrim recalled him, and he returned unwillingly. But he proved a good and a wise king. Though the speech of Gondor was used in his house, and not all men thought that good. Morwen bore him 2 more daughters in Rohan, and the last, Théodwin, was the fairest, though she came late, the child of his age. Her brother loved her dearly. It was soon after Thingol's return that Saruman declared himself Lord of Isengard, and began to give trouble to Rohan, encroaching on its borders and supporting its enemies. The 17th king was Théoden, born in 2948. He is called Théoden Ednil in the lore of Rohan, for he fell into a decline under the spells of Saruman, but was healed by Gandalf, and in the last year of his life arose and led his men to victory at the Hornburg, and soon after to the fields of Pelennor, the greatest battle of the age. He fell before the gates of Mundberg. For a while he rested in the land of his birth, among the dead kings of Gondor, but was brought back and laid in the 8th mound of his line at Edoras. Then a new line was begun. The third line. In 2989, Théodwin married Éomund of Eastfold, the chief marshal of the Mark. Her son, Éomer, was born in 2991, and her daughter, Éowyn, in 2995. At that time Sauron had arisen again, and the shadow of Mordor reached out to Rohan. Orcs began to raid in the eastern regions and slay or steal horses. Others also came down from the Misty Mountains, many being great Uruks in the service of Saruman, though it was long before that was suspected. Éomund's chief charge lay in the East Marches, and he was a great lover of horses and hater of orcs. If news came of a raid, he would often ride against them in hot anger, unwarily, and with few men. Thus it came about that he was slain in 3002. For he pursued a small band to the borders of the Emynweald, and was there surprised by a strong force that lay in wait in the rocks. Not long after, Théodwin took sick, and died, to the great grief of the king. Her children he took into his house, calling them son and daughter. He had only one child of his own, Théodred his son, then 24 years old. For the queen Elfhild had died in childbirth, and Théoden did not wed again. Éomer and Éowyn grew up in Edoras, and saw the dark shadow fall on the hall of Théoden. Éomer was like his fathers before him, but Éowyn was slender and tall, with a grace and pride that came to her out of the south from Morwen of Lossarnoch, whom the Rohirrim had called Steel-Sheen. The third line began with King Éomer Éadig. He was born in 2991. When still young, he became a Marshal of the Mark, and was given his father's charge in the East Marches. In the War of the Ring, Théodred fell in battle with Saruman at the crossings of Isen. Therefore, before he died on the fields of the Pelennor, Théoden named Éomer his heir, and called him king. In that day, Éowyn also won renown, for she fought in that battle, riding in disguise, and was known after in the Mark as the Lady of the Shield Arm. For her shield arm was broken by the mace of the Witch King, but he was brought to nothing. And thus the words of Glorfindel long before to King Eärnor were fulfilled, that the Witch King would not fall by the hand of man. For it is said in the songs of the Mark, that in this deed Éowyn had the aid of Théoden's esquire, and that he also was not a man but a halfling out of a far country, though Eomer gave him honour in the mark and the name of Holdwine. This Holdwine was none other than Meriadoc the Magnificent, who was master of Buckland. Eomer became a great king, and being young when he succeeded Theoden, he reigned for 65 years, longer than all their kings before him, save Aldor the Old. In the War of the Ring he made the friendship of King Elessar, and of Imrahil of Dol Amroth, and he rode often to Gondor. In the last year of the Third Age he wedded Lothiriel, daughter of Imrahil. Their son, Elfwine the Fair, ruled after him. In Eomer's day in the Mark, men had peace who wished for it, and the people increased both in the dales and the plains, and their horses multiplied. In Gondor the king Elessar now ruled, and in Arnor also. In all the lands of those realms of old he was king, save in Rohan only, for he renewed to Eomer the gift of Cirion, and Eomer took again the oath of Eol. Often he fulfilled it, for though Sauron had passed, the hatreds and evils that he bred had not died, and the king of the West had many enemies to subdue before the white tree could grow in peace. And wherever King Elessar went with war, King Eomer went with him, and beyond the Sea of Rûn, and on the far fields of the south, the thunder of the cavalry of the Mark was heard, and the white horse upon green flew in many winds until Eomer grew old. Part 3. Durin's Folk. Concerning the beginning of the dwarves, strange tales are told, both by the Eldar and by the dwarves themselves. But since these things lie far back beyond our days, little is said of them here. Durin is the name that the dwarves used for the eldest of the 7 fathers of their race, and the ancestor of all the kings of the Longbeards. He slept alone, until in the deeps of time, and the awakening of that people, he came to Azan-ul-Zebar, and in the caves above Khaled-Zaram, in the east of the Misty Mountains, he made his dwelling, where afterwards were the mines of Moria, renowned in song. There he lived so long that he was known far and wide as Durin the Deathless. Yet in the end he died before the elder days had passed, and his tomb was in Khazad-dûm, but his line never failed. And 5 times an heir was born in his house, so like to his forefather, that he received the name of Durin. He was indeed held by the dwarves to be the deathless that returned, for they have many strange tales and beliefs concerning themselves and their fate in the world. After the end of the First Age, the power and wealth of Khazad-dûm was much increased, for it was enriched by many people and much lore and craft, when the ancient cities of Nogrod and Belagost in the Blue Mountains were ruined at the breaking of Thangorodrim. The power of Moria endured throughout the Dark Years, and the dominion of Sauron, for though Eregion was destroyed, and the gates of Moria were shut, the halls of Khazad-dûm were too deep and strong, and filled with a people too numerous and valiant, for Sauron to conquer from without. Thus its wealth remained long unravished, though its people began to dwindle. It came to pass that in the middle of the Third Age, Durin was again its king, being the 6th of that name. The power of Sauron, servant of Morgoth, was then again growing in the world, though the shadow in the forest that looked towards Moria was not yet known for what it was. All evil things were stirring. The dwarves delved deep at that time, seeking beneath Barazinbar for Mithril, the metal beyond price that was becoming yearly ever harder to win. Thus they roused from sleep a thing of terror that, flying from Thangorodrim, had lain hidden at the foundations of the earth since the coming of the host of the West, a Balrog of Morgoth. Or perhaps they released it from prison. It may well be that it had already been awakened by the malice of Sauron. Durin was slain by it, and the year after, Nine the First, his son. And then the glory of Moria passed, and its people were destroyed or fled far away. Most of those that escaped made their way into the north, and Thrain the First, Nine's son, came to Erebor, the lonely mountain, near the eastern eaves of Mirkwood, and there he began new works, and became king under the mountain. In Erebor he found the great jewel, the Arkenstone, heart of the mountain. But Thorin the First, his son, removed and went into the far north to the Grey Mountains, where most of Durin's folk were now gathering, for those mountains were rich and little explored. But there were dragons in the wastes beyond, and after many years they became strong again and multiplied, and they made war on the dwarves and plundered their works. At last Dain the First, together with Thror, his second son, was slain at the doors of his hall by a great cold drake. Not long after most of Durin's folk abandoned the Grey Mountains, Gror, Dain's son, went away with many followers to the Iron Hills, but Thror, Dain's heir, with Borin, his father's brother, and the remainder of the people, returned to Erebor. To the great hall of Thrain, Thror brought back the Arkenstone, and he and his folk prospered and became rich, and they had the friendship of all men that dwelt near. For they made not only things of wonder and beauty, but weapons and armor of great worth, and there was great traffic of ore between them and their kin in the Iron Hills. Thus the Northmen who lived between Kelduin, River Running, and Carnen, Red Water, became strong and drove back all enemies from the east, and the dwarves lived in plenty, and there was feasting and song in the halls of Erebor. So the rumour of the wealth of Erebor spread abroad and reached the ears of the dragons, and at last Smaug the Golden, greatest of the dragons of his day, arose and without warning came against King Thror and descended on the mountain in flames. It was not long before all that realm was destroyed, and the town of Dale nearby was ruined and deserted. But Smaug entered into the great hall and lay there upon a bed of gold. From the sack and the burning many of Thror's kin escaped, and last of all from the halls by a secret door came Thror himself and his son Thrain the Second. They went away south into long and homeless wandering with their family, among whom were the children of Thrain the Second: Thorin Oakenshield, Freyrin, and Dis. Thorin was then a youngster in the reckoning of the dwarves. With them went also a small company of their kinsmen and faithful followers. It was afterwards learned that more of the folk under the mountain had escaped than was at first hoped, but most of these went to the Iron Hills. Years afterwards Thror, now old, poor, and desperate, gave to his son Thrain the one great treasure he still possessed, the last of the Seven Rings, and then he went away with one old companion only, called Nar. Of the ring he said to Thrain at their parting,
"This may prove the foundation of new fortune for you yet, though that seems unlikely, but it needs gold to breed gold." "Surely you do not think of returning to Erebor?" said Thrain.
"Not at my age," said Thror. "Our vengeance on Smaug I bequeath to you and your sons, but I'm tired of poverty and the scorn of men. I go to see what I can find."
He did not say where. He was a little crazed, perhaps, with age and misfortune, and long brooding on the splendour of Moria in his forefathers' days, or the ring, it may be, was turned to evil now that its master was awake, driving him to folly and destruction. From Dunland, where he was then dwelling, he went north with Nar, and they crossed the Redhorn Pass, and came down into Azan-ul-Zibar. When Thror came to Moria, the gate was open. Nar begged him to beware, but he took no heed of him, and walked proudly in as an heir that returns, but he did not come back. Na stayed nearby for many days in hiding. One day he heard a loud shout and the blare of a horn, and a body was flung out on the steps. Fearing that it was Thro, he began to creep near. But there came a voice from within the gate.
"Come on, beardling! We can see you, but there's no need to be afraid today. We need you as a messenger."
Then Na came up, and found that it was indeed the body of Thro, but the head was severed and lay face downwards. As he knelt there, he heard orc laughter in the shadows, and the voice said,
"If beggars will not wait at the door, but sneak in to try thieving, that's what we do to them. If any of your people poke their foul beards in here again, they will fare the same. Go and tell them so. But if his family wish to know who is now king here, the name is written on his face. I wrote it. I killed him. I am the master."
Then Na turned the head, and saw, branded on the brow in dwarf runes, so that he could read it, the name Azog. That name was branded in his heart, and in the hearts of all the dwarves afterwards. Na stooped to take the head, but the voice of Azog said,
"Drop it. Be off. Here's your fee, beggar beard."
A small bag struck him. It held a few coins of little worth. Weeping, Na fled down the silver load, but he looked back once and saw that orcs had come from the gate and were hacking up the body and flinging the pieces to the black crows. Such was the tale that Na brought back to Thrain, and when he had wept and torn his beard, he fell silent. 7 days he sat and said no word. Then he stood up and said,
"This cannot be borne."
That was the beginning of the war of the dwarves and the orcs, which was long and deadly, and fought for the most part in deep places beneath the earth. Thrain at once sent messengers bearing the tale north, east, and west, but it was 3 years before the dwarves had mustered their strength.
Durin's folk gathered all their host, and they were joined by great forces sent from the houses of the other fathers. For this dishonour to the heir of the eldest of their race filled them with wrath. When all was ready, they assailed and sacked, one by one, all the strongholds of the orcs that they could, from Gundabad to the Gladden. Both sides were pitiless, and there was death and cruel deeds by dark and by light. But the dwarves had the victory through their strength, and their matchless weapons, and the fire of their anger, as they hunted for Azog in every den under mountain. At last all the orcs that fled before them were gathered in Moria, and the dwarf host, in pursuit, came to Azanulbizar. That was a great vale that lay between the arms of the mountains about the lake of Haledzaram, and had been of old part of the kingdom of Hazard-Dûm. When the dwarves saw the gate of their ancient mansions upon the hillside, they sent up a great shout like thunder in the valley. But a great host of foes was arrayed on the slopes above them, and out of the gates poured a multitude of orcs that had been held back by Azog for the last need. At first fortune was against the dwarves, for it was a dark day of winter without sun, and the orcs did not waver, and they outnumbered their enemies, and had the higher ground. So began the battle of Azanulbizar, or Nandohirion in the Elvish tongue, at the memory of which the orcs still shudder and the dwarves weep. The first assault of the vanguard, led by Thrain, was thrown back with loss, and Thrain was driven into a wood of great trees that then still grew not far from Kaledzaram. There Freyrin his son fell, and Fundin his kinsman, and many others, and both Thrain and Thorin were wounded. Elsewhere the battle swayed to and fro with great slaughter, until at last the people of the Iron Hills turned the day. Coming late and fresh to the field, the mailed warriors of Nine, Gror's son, drove through the orcs to the very threshold of Moria, crying, "Azog! Azog!" as they hewed down with their mattocks all who stood in their way. It is said that Thorin's shield was cloven, and he cast it away,
And he hewed off with his axe a branch of an oak, and held it in his left hand to ward off the strokes of his foes, or to wield as a club. In this way he got his name. Then Nine stood before the gate, and cried with a great voice,
Azog, if you are in, come out, or is the play in the valley too rough?
Thereupon Azog came forth, and he was a great orc with a huge iron-clad head, and yet agile and strong. With him came many like him, the fighters of his guard, and as they engaged Nine's company, he turned to Nine and said,
What? Yet another beggar at my doors? Must I brand you too?
With that he rushed at Nine, and they fought. But Nine was half blind with rage, and also very weary with battle, whereas Azog was fresh and fell, and full of guile. Soon Nine made a great stroke with all his strength that remained, but Azog darted aside and kicked Nine's leg, so that the mattock splintered on the stone where he had stood. But Nine stumbled forward. Then Azog, with a swift swing, hewed his neck. His mail collar withstood the edge, but so heavy was the blow that Nine's neck was broken, and he fell. Then Azog laughed, and he lifted up his head to let forth a great yell of triumph, but the cry died in his throat. For he saw that all his host in the valley was in a rout, and the dwarves went this way and that, slaying as they would, and those that could escape from them were flying south, shrieking as they ran, and hard by all the soldiers of his guard lay dead. He turned and fled backwards towards the gate. Up the steps after him leapt a dwarf with a red axe. It was Dain Ironfoot, Nine's son. Right before the doors he caught Azog, and there he slew him and hewed off his head. That was held a great feat, for Dain was then only a stripling in the reckoning of the dwarves. But long life and many battles lay before him, until old but unbowed he fell at last in the War of the Ring. Yet hardy and full of wrath as he was, it is said that when he came down from the gate he looked grey in the face, as one who has felt great fear. When at last the battle was won, the dwarves that were left gathered in Azanulbizar. They took the head of Azog, and thrust into its mouth the purse of small money, and then they set it on a stake. But no feast nor song was there that night, for their dead were beyond the count of grief. Barely half of their number, it is said, could still stand or had hope of healing. Nonetheless, in the morning Thrine stood before them. He had one eye blinded beyond cure, and he was halt with a leg wound, but he said,
Good! We have won the victory! Khazad Dûm is ours!
But they answered,
Durin's heir you may be, but even with one eye you should see clearer. We fought this war for vengeance, and vengeance we have taken, but it is not sweet. If this is victory, then our hands are too small to hold it.
And those who were not of Durin's folk said also,
Khazad Dûm was not our father's house. What is it to us, unless a hope of treasure? But now, if we must go without the rewards and the weir-guilds that are owed to us, the sooner we return to our own lands, the better pleased we shall be.
Then Thrine turned to Dain and said,
But surely my own kin will not desert me.
No, said Dain, you are the father of our folk, and we have bled for you, and will again. But we will not enter Khazad Dûm. You will not enter Khazad Dûm. Only I have looked through the shadow of the gate. Beyond the shadow, it waits for you still, Durin's bane. The world must change, and some other power than ours must come before Durin's folk walk again in Moria.
So it was that after Azanulbizar the dwarves dispersed again. But first with great labour they stripped all their dead, so that orcs should not come and win there a store of weapons and mail. It is said that every dwarf that went from that battlefield was bowed under a heavy burden. Then they built many pyres and burned all the bodies of their kin. There was a great felling of trees in the valley, which remained bare ever after, and the reek of the burning was seen in Lorien. Such dealings with their dead seemed grievous to the dwarves, for it was against their use.
but to make such tombs as they were accustomed to build, since they will lay their dead only in stone, not in earth, would have taken many years. To fire, therefore, they turned, rather than leave their kin to beast or bird or carrion orc. But those who fell in Azan-ul-Bizar were honored in memory, and to this day a dwarf will say proudly of one of his sires, "He was a burned dwarf, and that is enough." When the dreadful fires were in ashes, the allies went away to their own countries, and Dain Ironfoot led his father's people back to the Iron Hills. Then, standing by the great stake, Thrain said to Thorin Oakenshield,
"Some would think this head dearly bought. At least we have given our kingdom for it. Will you come with me back to the anvil, or will you beg your bread at proud doors?" "To the anvil," answered Thorin. "The hammer will at least keep the arms strong until they can wield sharper tools again."
So Thrain and Thorin, with what remained of their following, among whom were Balin and Gloin, returned to Dunland, and soon afterwards they removed and wandered in Eriador, until at last they made a home in exile in the east of Ered Luin, beyond the Loon. Of iron were most of the things that they forged in those days, but they prospered after a fashion, and their numbers slowly increased. They had very few womenfolk. Dis, Thrain's daughter, was there. She was the mother of Fili and Kili, who were born in the Ered Luin. Thorin had no wife. But, as Thror had said, the ring needed gold to breed gold, and of that, or any other precious metal, they had little or none. Of this ring, something may be said here. It was believed by the dwarves of Durin's folk to be the first of the seven that was forged, and they say that it was given to the king of Hazad-Dûm, Durin the Third, by the elven smiths themselves, and not by Sauron, though doubtless his evil power was on it, since he had aided in the forging of all the seven. But the possessors of the ring did not display it or speak of it, and they seldom surrendered it until near their death, so that others did not know for certain where it was bestowed. Some thought that it had remained in Khazad-dûm, in the secret tombs of the kings, if they had not been discovered and plundered. But among the kindred of Durin's heir it was believed, wrongly, that Thror had worn it when he rashly returned there. What then had become of it, they did not know. It was not found on the body of Azog. Nonetheless, it may well be, as the dwarves now believe, that Sauron, by his arts, had discovered who had this ring, the last to remain free, and that the singular misfortunes of the heirs of Durin were largely due to his malice, for the dwarves had proved untamable by this means. The only power over them that the rings wielded was to inflame their hearts with a greed of gold and precious things, so that if they lacked them, all other good things seemed profitless, and they were filled with wrath and desire for vengeance on all who deprived them. But they were made from their beginning of a kind to resist most steadfastly any domination. Though they could be slain or broken, they could not be reduced to shadows enslaved to another will, and for the same reason their lives were not affected by any ring, to live either longer or shorter because of it. All the more did Sauron hate the possessors and desire to dispossess them. It was therefore, perhaps, partly by the malice of the ring, that Thrain, after some years, became restless and discontented. The lust for gold was ever in his mind. At last, when he could endure it no longer, he turned his thoughts to Erebor, and resolved to go back there. He said nothing to Thorin of what was in his heart, but with Balin and Dwalin and a few others, he arose and said farewell and departed. Little is known of what happened to him afterwards. It would now seem that as soon as he was abroad with few companions, he was hunted by the emissaries of Sauron. Wolves pursued him, orcs waylaid him, evil birds shadowed his path, and the more he strove to go north, the more misfortunes opposed him. There came a dark night when he and his companions were wandering in the land beyond Anduin, and they were driven by a black rain to take shelter under the eaves of Mirkwood. In the morning he was gone from the camp, and his companions called him in vain. They searched for him many days, until at last, giving up hope, they departed, and came at length back to Thorin. Only long after was it learned that Thrain had been taken alive, and brought to the pits of Dol Guldur. There he was tormented, and the ring taken from him, and there at last he died. So Thorin Oakenshield became the heir of Durin, but an heir without hope. When Thrain was lost he was 95, a great dwarf of proud bearing, but he seemed content to remain in Eriador. There he laboured long, and trafficked, and gained such wealth as he could, and his people were increased by many of the wandering folk of Durin, who heard of his dwelling in the west and came to him. Now they had fair halls in the mountains, and store of goods, and their days did not seem so hard, though in their songs they spoke ever of the lonely mountain far away. The years lengthened. The embers in the heart of Thorin grew hot again, as he brooded on the wrongs of his house and the vengeance upon the dragon that he had inherited. He thought of weapons and armies and alliances as his great hammer rang in his forge, but the armies were dispersed and the alliances broken, and the axes of his people were few, and a great anger without hope burned him as he smote the red iron on the anvil. But at last there came about, by chance, a meeting between Gandalf and Thorin that changed all the fortunes of the House of Durin, and led to other and greater ends beside. On a time Thorin, returning west from a journey, stayed at Bree for the night. There Gandalf was also. He was on his way to the Shire, which he had not visited for some 20 years. He was weary, and thought to rest there for a while. Among many cares he was troubled in mind by the perilous state of the North, because he knew then already that Sauron was plotting war, and intended, as soon as he felt strong enough, to attack Rivendell, but to resist any attempt from the east to regain the lands of Angmar and the northern passes in the mountains, there were now only the dwarves of the Iron Hills, and beyond them lay the desolation of the dragon. The dragon Sauron might use with terrible effect. How then could the end of Smaug be achieved? It was even as Gandalf sat and pondered this that Thorin stood before him and said,
"Master Gandalf, I know you only by sight, but now I should be glad to speak with you, for you have often come into my thoughts of late, as if I were bidden to seek you. Indeed, I should have done so if I had known where to find you."
Gandalf looked at him in wonder.
"That is strange, Thorin Oakenshield," he said, "for I have thought of you also, and though I am on my way to the Shire, it was in my mind that is the way also to your halls."
"Call them so, if you will," said Thorin. "They are only poor lodgings in exile, but you would be welcome there if you would come, for they say that you are wise, and know more than any other of what goes on in the world, and I have much on my mind, and would be glad of your counsel."
"I will come," said Gandalf, "for I guess that we share one trouble at least. The dragon of Erebor is on my mind, and I do not think that he will be forgotten by the grandson of Thror."
The story is told elsewhere of what came of that meeting, of the strange plan that Gandalf made for the help of Thorin, and how Thorin and his companions set out from the Shire on the quest of the lonely mountain that came to great ends unforeseen. Here only those things are recalled that directly concern Durin's folk. The dragon was slain by Bard of Esgaroth, but there was battle in Dale, for the orcs came down upon Erebor as soon as they heard of the return of the dwarves, and they were led by Bolg, son of that Azog whom Dain slew in his youth. In that first battle of Dale, Thorin Oakenshield was mortally wounded, and he died and was laid in a tomb under the mountain with the Arkenstone upon his breast. There fell also Fili and Kili, his sister's sons, But Dain Ironfoot, his cousin, who came from the Iron Hills to his aid, and was also his rightful heir, became then King Dain the Second, and the kingdom under the mountain was restored, even as Gandalf had desired. Dain proved a great and wise king, and the dwarves prospered and grew strong again in his day. In the late summer of that same year, 2941, Gandalf had at last prevailed upon Saruman and the White Council to attack Dol Guldur, and Sauron retreated and went to Mordor, there to be secure, as he thought, from all his enemies. So it was that when the war came at last, the main assault was turned southwards. Yet even so, with his far-stretched right hand, Sauron might have done great evil in the north, if King Dain and King Brand had not stood in his path. Even as Gandalf said afterwards to Frodo and Gimli, when they dwelt together for a time in Minas Tirith. Not long before news had come to Gondor of events far away.
"I grieved at the fall of Thorin," said Gandalf, "and now we hear that Dain has fallen, fighting in Dale again, even while we fought here. I should call that a heavy loss, if it was not a wonder, rather, that in his great age he could still wield his axe as mightily as they say that he did, standing over the body of King Brand before the gate of Erebor until the darkness fell. Yet things might have gone far otherwise and far worse. When you think of the great battle of the Pelennor, do not forget the battles in Dale and the valour of Durin's folk. Think of what might have been. Dragonfire and savage swords in Eriador, night in Rivendell. There might be no queen in Gondor. We might now hope to return from the victory here only to ruin and ash. But that has been averted, because I met Thorin Oakenshield one evening on the edge of Spring and Bree. A chance meeting, as we say in Middle-earth."
This was the daughter of Thrain the Second. She is the only dwarf woman named in these histories. It was said by Gimli that there are few dwarf women, probably no more than a third of the whole people. They seldom walk abroad except at great need. They are in voice and appearance, and in garb if they must go on a journey, so like to the dwarf men that the eyes and ears of other peoples cannot tell them apart. This has given rise to the foolish opinion among men that there are no dwarf women, and that the dwarves grow out of stone. It is because of the fewness of women among them that the kind of the dwarves increases slowly, and is in peril when they have no secure dwellings, for dwarves take only one wife or husband each in their lives, and are jealous, as in all matters of their rights. The number of dwarf men that marry is actually less than one-third. For not all the women take husbands. Some desire none. Some desire one that they cannot get, and so will have no other. As for the men, very many also do not desire marriage, being engrossed in their crafts. Gimli Glóin's son is renowned, for he was one of the nine walkers that set out with the ring, and he remained in the company of King Elessar throughout the war. He was named Elfrend, because of the great love that grew between him and Legolas, son of King Thranduil, and because of his reverence for the Lady Galadriel. After the fall of Sauron, Gimli brought south a part of the dwarf folk of Erebor, and he became lord of the Glittering Caves. He and his people did great works in Gondor and Rohan. For Minas Tirith they forged gates of mithril and steel to replace those broken by the Witch-King. Legolas, his friend, also brought some elves out of Greenwood, and they dwelt in Ithilien, and it became once again the fairest country in all the Westlands. But when King Elessar gave up his life, Legolas followed at last the desire of his heart and sailed over sea. Here follows one of the last notes in the Red Book. We have heard tell that Legolas took Gimli, Glóin's son, with him because of their great friendship, greater than any that has been between elf and dwarf. If this is true, then it is strange indeed that a dwarf should be willing to leave Middle-earth for any love, or that the Eldar should receive him, or that the lords of the West should permit it. But it is said that Gimli went also out of desire to see again the beauty of Galadriel, and it may be that she, being mighty among the Eldar, obtained this grace for him. More cannot be said of this matter.
The End. You've been listening to The Annals of the Kings and Rulers by J.R.R. Tolkien, narrated by Robert Inglis. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books hopes you'll join us on another heroic quest one day soon. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide using the telephone number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalogue, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.